Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 216th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and this episode is brought to you by Showtime. Academy Award nominee Benedict Cumberbatch stars in the new Showtime limited event series, Patrick Melrose. In this tour de force performance, Cumberbatch brings to life the story of one man's journey toward redemption and survival. Patrick Melrose premieres May 12th, only on Showtime. My guest today is one of the funniest women, correction, one of the funniest people in the world, Samantha Bee. The Canadian-born comic was the longest-serving and first female correspondent on Comedy Central's The Daily Show, with a tenure there spanning 12 years from 2003 through 2015. Then, at roughly the same time that host Jon Stewart left the show, she did too, heading to TBS as the creator, writer, executive producer, and host of TBS's Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, which made her the first woman ever to host a late-night satire show. The 21-minute, once-a-week program debuted on February 8, 2016, and thanks largely to Bee's on-screen persona as a woman raging against idiocy, quickly found a large and passionate following. Within a year, its viewership was up 167%, and it was the most-watched late-night show among people in the much-prized 18 to 34 demographic. And within 2 years, it was nominated for the Best Variety Talk Series Emmy and won the Emmy for Best Writing for a Variety Special, in recognition of its one-time offshoot, Not the White House Correspondents' Dinner. While Samantha Bee makes no bones about the fact that she would prefer that Donald Trump had not been elected president, I think it's a fairly safe bet that Donald Trump would prefer that Samantha Bee had not been entrusted with her own show. In getting one, she not only broke a glass ceiling, she also acquired a perch through which she constantly checks Trump and keeps the rest of us laughing. But first, I was joined at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter by my colleague Seth Abramovich, a senior writer here who has written a terrific piece in this week's issue about Jeffrey Tambor. Tambor, of course, is the veteran character actor best known for The Larry Sanders Show, Arrested Development, and, most recently, Transparent, a show about a person, largely inspired by creator Jill Soloway's father, who comes out as a woman after living for decades as a man. That show debuted on Amazon in September of 2014, and Tambor was awarded the Best Actor in a Comedy Series Emmy in 2015 and 2016 in recognition of his work on its first two seasons, and he was nominated for it again in 2017 in recognition of his work on its third. The show's fourth season dropped in September of 2017. In October of 2017, allegations of widespread sexual misconduct by Harvey Weinstein sparked the Me Too and Time's Up movements that brought forward allegations of sexual misconduct against many other powerful men in Hollywood. And in November of 2017, Tambor became one of them, and ultimately was fired from Transparent in February of 2018. Now, 3 months later, he has opened up at length for the first time in The Hollywood Reporter. Seth, congrats on a fascinating story. For people who may not know, can you set this up a little bit and just tell us what Jeffrey Tambor has been accused of that turned this really illustrious career kind of upside down in the last year?
Sure. There's two accusers that have come up publicly. One is Van Barnes, who is a trans woman who was his assistant. They met on the set. She moved here from Missouri to be his assistant. And during the first sweep of Me Too, you know, proclamations online, she got caught up in it and wrote her own on Facebook, in which she made a lot of accusations that he used to pat her on the butt, that he would speak very dirty to her, that he subjected her to listening to porn while she was in the next room, and that he would make sort of propositions to her that if she slept with him, he would pay her a decent salary, which she said she wasn't making. She never mentioned his name in it, but everyone in the community knew that she was his assistant. It had to be him. Mm-hmm. That immediately started an Amazon Studios investigation into her claims. After that, a second accuser, Trace Lissette, who's an actress on the show, who plays a character named Shay, came forward actually to The Hollywood Reporter and myself with her own set of accusations. Hers were different. They were that he would sort of be too handsy, too kissy. He would kiss her on the lips. He was very sort of friendly to her at the beginning. Then she said he crossed a line when they were shooting a famous scene that went viral in which he's trying to learn how to say the expression "Yas, queen." And that when she first came out in her pajamas, he said that he wanted to attack her sexually. And then after they were shooting it, he sort of cornered her on the set. He was wearing sort of a pajamas or a robe as well, and he was sort of thrusting against her, and she could feel his genitalia against him. And that was what she felt was a fireable offense. And so she came forward with that accusation, and those were the two that Amazon then investigated.
And then subsequently it came out from one of these women, both of whom are trans, right? One of them said that Tambor had lived at her home for a period of weeks when his home was being renovated and had been caught watching her sleeping in the nude. Is that right?
Something like that. Basically, it wasn't renovated, but he lives on the East Coast in Katona, New York. And so when he was shooting the show, he was being put up in a house in the Pacific Palisades. And the house wasn't ready for him a couple weeks before shooting was to start. And he was sort of responsible for his own lodging at that point. And the two accusers were both house-sitting the house that belongs to one of the producer's parents. It's a very strange story, but basically he said, oh, that house has an extra bedroom. Could I stay there? And they said, sure, I guess. And for 2 weeks, he was living with them. And that's when Van Barnes claims he had later admitted to her that he was observing her sleep naked.
And Tambor, to you, acknowledges that he stayed in that home, disputes the idea that he ever was watching somebody sleep naked, and also disputes any of the other sexual allegations that have been made against him, right?
Yes. He sort of gives me a flat denial of anything involving sexual harassment or sexual behavior, and a umbrella admission to anything that involves verbally castigating or, you know, these tantrums, anything that involves sort of abuse that isn't sexual. He takes responsibility for anything that is sexual, he denies.
And what he really seems to imply, I think, and correct me if you disagree, but he seems to be saying to you that he really thinks the root of the desire to kind of get him is that the trans community, which this show has shone a light on for several years now, has now kind of increasingly arrived at the conclusion that they do not like a cisgender person playing the lead of a show about trans people. They call it trans face, like blackface, and that Jill Soloway, the creator of the show, who now, since the show has been on Amazon, identifies no longer as a woman, but rather as gender non-binary, as a now a member of the LGBTQ community, that Jill Soloway also felt pressured now to essentially cut ties with him in order to placate the LGBTQ community. Is there any reason to believe that that is actually the case?
I'm going to abstain from that. That is just, it's, this is where it gets super thorny and different from any other Me Too case. And that there's all this sort of sexual political stuff going on in the background that led up to it. And you're right. He does strongly suggest that this was a sort of setup, that certain powers that be or people around involved in the show did not want him playing the character because he's not trans, and that they sort of got together and came up with a plan to get him fired. But of course, that doesn't excuse or explain any of his, you know, abusive behavior on the set, which he admits, you know, would go from the lowest person on the totem pole to, like, you know, an assistant coming to get him in his trailer to Jill Soloway. That, you know, so no one was spared from his wrath. And some people might say that's reason enough, that, you know, justification for him not to have that job anymore. But as far as, you know, this conspiracy that he was ousted for his you know, cisgender status, I don't know. I just know that it came up a lot, and he certainly was pushing that theory as well.
And there's sort of a lot of palace intrigue aspect to this, right? I mean, there are people that will argue that Jill Soloway and Transparent, really a lot of the success of the show is attributable to this Jeffrey Tambor performance that was winning Emmys right off the bat. And yet it sounds like the way he was initially notified of his termination was not necessarily handled all that well. And you know, the implication from him is that it seemed disloyal and inappropriate to get rid of him via a text message, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's no nice way to tell someone they're fired, right, and certainly not in these circumstances. So I sympathize with Jill in that way. You know, he also feels that she hasn't come out in support of him enough. And she was quite frank in telling me that she couldn't really, you know, come out in favor of him and against the accusers. That it just wasn't possible. And so I feel she was in a really sticky place because she was in service of this transgender community that took her under her wing and whose story they entrusted to her. And to this actor who, you know, brought the story alive and won all these awards, and maybe the show would never would have quite worked if it hadn't been with him. It's hard to say.
So talk, if you can, about where you met up with Tambor and what his day-to-day life and state of mind are like today. Is this a guy who is just getting on with things, or is he having a hard time with all of this?
He was definitely having a hard time. He looked tired and very emotionally spent and sort of stunned. You know, he kept referring to being in this fugue state, and you could tell that, you know, this had really gotten to him. And by the end of the afternoon, it had gotten to me, too. It was very draining, emotionally draining to be with him.
And you said he broke down how many times?
He broke down 5 times crying, yeah. The character is very close to him. You know, he would speak in terms of death and grieving and that seemed very sincere to me, that it wasn't just the end of a job. It really was the death of someone who had become, you know, part of him. And, of course, you know, all the criticism and the, you know, he's been turned from this folk hero to a villain. He's trying to figure out how he maneuvers the next stage of his career.
Well, I want to ask you, because I mean, just to set the stage, this is a podcast called Awards Chatter. In terms of awards, he is actually technically in the running this year again for Transparent, having been nominated last year and won the 2 years prior. This is because the season that is eligible this year is the one that aired or streamed in the fall of last year. And yet, despite his track record, there is nobody that gives him any prayer in hell of even being in the running this year. It's not that the performance has changed. It's that the community, I guess, that's a reflection of the fact that he's sort of become a bit of a pariah. At the same time, he is also potentially going to be in the running for Arrested Development, because that show is coming back on Netflix and he is in new episodes there. So where does Jeffrey Tambor stand at the moment?
I don't know. It's a good question. As far as awards go, you know, it's not just him. It seems like Amazon has completely abandoned the entire show in terms of the way they're promoting their series. And so, you know, I think nothing from the show should expect to get nominated, although I'm not the awards pundit. And then as far as Arrested goes, you know, they're entering into what should be an awkward period where they're going to have a premiere and media appearances. And, you know, he's going to be shoulder to shoulder with the rest of his cast. And I'm sure he's going to be asked questions about this, and they are going to be asked questions. I don't know. I doubt that Arrested is going to get him an Emmy nomination. I just think things are just a little too touchy right now for awards. But as far as his career goes, gee, I don't know.
I mean, he's 73 years old to begin with. It's actually, I think he was the oldest person ever to win an Emmy in the category in which he won for those 2 years. Normally at 73, you're not working that much at this high a level to begin with. So I don't know where that leaves him.
Yeah, you know, part of all this grieving, you know, as I interpret it, was that he knew that this was the role of a lifetime, coming off, you know, a perfect hat trick of roles, and that he realistically doesn't see at this point another part like this coming along. But as he put it to me, you know, he's just trying to get through this day by day. And right now, you know, he's in the eye of the storm. Mm-hmm. And I think he's just trying to put some distance between it. I think that's why he did the story. He thought maybe that could sort of put a period on it and he could move on. Whether the public feels the same way is yet to be seen, I guess.
Well, it is a fascinating story. Seth Abramovich, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And now for my interview with Samantha Bee. Over the course of our conversation at Full Frontal's offices in Midtown Manhattan, the 48-year-old and I discussed a wide range of topics. Among them, why, for much of her adolescence in Canada, she was essentially a juvenile delinquent, and what motivated her, just before graduating from high school, to clean up her act, how she first discovered that she was funny and broke into sketch comedy in Toronto, and how, while there, she was discovered by The Daily Show, which was struggling to find a sufficiently funny woman stateside, what her fondest memories and biggest takeaways were from her 12 years working under Jon Stewart and alongside a host of other talented comics who also now have late-night shows of their own, including Stephen Colbert, John Oliver, Trevor Noah, and Jordan Klepper, why, when Stewart announced his departure in 2015, she decided not to stick around and wait to see if she would be offered the chance to succeed him as The Daily Show's host, but instead headed over to TBS. How, with Full Frontal, her overall mission and screen persona were already in place prior to the presidential election on November 8th, 2016, but how Donald Trump's unexpected victory changed the day-to-day challenges of putting together the show, plus much more. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We always begin with stuff that I guess you could very easily Google, but just for the record, where were you born and raised? What did your folks do for a living?
I was born in Toronto, in the province of Ontario, in Canada. And my dad, he worked for Humber College for a while, but he set up computer systems for companies. So he kind of worked as a consultant. And my mother worked for the government. She worked for Revenue Canada. And my stepmom worked for Humber College. I've got a big kind of family in that sense.
Well, I actually read that your grandmother was a particularly important person
in your life. She was. I lived with her for a really long time. She was also the secretary of the school that I attended, the grade school. The Catholic grade school that I went to. So she was a total fixture in my life.
Well, and so how was it that you spent a lot of your childhood with her?
Well, my parents were really young, actually, when they had me. My mom had just turned 19.
Wow.
So I was like a teen birth, and she was just more equipped to take care of me for the early years of my life. And so I think around the age of 8, I went to live with I ended up living with my mom for a while. And then my mother moved to a rural community. She bought a farm, actually, just outside of Ottawa, Canada. And she was like, yay, we're moving to a farm. And I was like, I'm not doing that.
And so
I moved back in with my grandmother's. But I spent so much time with her.
This
regardless.
Is your mother's mother?
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Just a kind of random aside, but why do you have any theory about why so many of the funniest people come from Canada?
You know what? It's so funny. People ask me that all the time. I have no idea. But we do have, there is a very robust comedy community, I will say. It's like a very DIY kind of comedy scene. And there were, certainly when I was coming up, there were plenty of spaces that you could go and just kind of use to sell enough drink tickets to justify your being there. But there were a lot of really interesting and cool spaces where you could go and perform. So the comedy scene was really quite robust, I would say. And we're also, the winter is cold. You have to amuse yourself. And there's a great tradition of comedy, too.
Yeah.
So you kind of want to live up to that on
some
level.
Before, I guess, you even really probably were even thinking about getting into comedy of any sort, I was kind of surprised to learn that you were a little bit of a juvenile delinquent.
I was a juvenile delinquent. That is true.
What was that
about?
For
a very brief period. It's actually, it's funny because I talk about it. It seems so shocking and strange. I mean, I don't have good feelings about it. It's not like I'm proud and I want my children to follow in my beautiful tradition of rebellion.
Right.
But I'm glad that I got the rebellion out of my system very early.
Yes, better
than
late.
I was about 15, 16 when that was happening.
What did this entail?
I had a boyfriend and he was a bad influence. You know, it's always a boy. It's always a bad influence, an outside figure. Because I was really a Catholic school girl. Gold star, steady, straight A student.
Right.
And so I went through that brief period for a year and a half or 2 years where we stole cars together.
You were a participant.
Oh, totally. Yes. A very willing, very active participant in a lot of
crime. It just the thrill of it, or what was the appeal?
No, I didn't find it thrilling. I was actually really quite terrified, but interesting. We already talked about, it was for practicality purposes, really, in our lives, because my parents hated him.
Yeah.
I mean, they loathed him. I mean, they really, probably their loathing of him drove me deeper into his arms.
Right.
And his parents loathed me equally.
Right.
I mean, for different reasons. And we just never had any place to go. And it was cold out. We couldn't go anywhere. Nobody would have us. We weren't allowed in each other's homes. So we would just hang out in cars, quite honestly. We were dead, really.
Well, we won't harp on this much longer, but I just want to confirm if one of these, the craziest thing is actually that I came across is actually true. Did you,
Self-harming sounds like something different than what I'm implying here.
Oh,
but
my gosh.
Did you do something with your hand?
I did. How did you hear about that? That's fascinated.
We'll dig into your past there.
I guess. I did. Yes, I did. It was so stupid. This I do regret. This was just a bad idea. But
right.
There was a real... That couple of years was a very strange time of just total... Not an inability to... I just had no ability to sense consequences of any kind.
This like
just
high school years?
High school years, yeah. But early high school years. Because actually, very shortly after this period of my life, and actually very shortly after the incident I'm about to describe, I snapped out of it hard. I just woke up one day and went, what am I doing? Like, what path am I going down?
Right.
This is not okay. And I did a full return to being a straight A student and a great...
Just in time.
Just in time.
Right.
Like, I saved myself.
Right.
I just woke up alert. Just the blinders came off. Because I'd been such a good student prior to this, there was a season in high school, the Christmas exams, I blew them off. I didn't go to them. I didn't study for the exams, and therefore I didn't feel like I could even go to the exam. So I just did not go because I didn't want to fail them. And I thought, if I just don't go, I'll back end
right.
a reason to have not been there. And my brilliant idea was that I slipped on the ice and sprained my hand or broke my hand. And so then I attempted to break my own hand, my writing hand, the hand that I rely on.
Yes.
Every single day. I thought, this is the best idea ever. I mean, this is just like the fog of teen years for me. I thought, this idea is terrific. No, it's infallible.
And how did you go?
No one will ever figure it out. And so I was with my bad boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And even he was amazed that I wanted to do this. Like, even he just did not know what to do with me. I really was in a state.
Right.
And I was like, I need you to break my hand tonight. You're going to break it with a rock. And he was like, I am not going to do that. And I was like, do it.
Oh,
break it.
God.
So I put my hand on the bumper of a car. This is such a sad story.
Hey, but there's a happy ending. So.
I don't want to be a bad example for people. I'm just, don't do what I did.
PSA, don't break your hand.
Don't even consider this. But this is just, anyway. So I put my hand on the bumper of a car. And I was like, hit it. I found a boulder. I gave it to him. I was like, hit my hand with a rock until it breaks. And he was like, I can't do it. And I was like, I'll do it. And so I did it. And then he
sorted. You did it to yourself.
Yeah, I did it to myself. And then he did it. And it did not break. But it was really, there were a couple of really hard hits on my hand. So it swelled up instantly. Like it just blew up, you know? And I was like, good. Thank you. Finally.
Right.
Really?
And did it work? Got you out of your exams?
Well, that was so late at night. And I was like wearing pearls and a cashmere sweater. It was in the winter. It was very cold. And so I was like, now we have to go to the hospital because I need to have been seen by a doctor now to get out of these exams. So I went to the doctor. They were like, did you try to break your hand? And I was like, no, idiot. I slipped on the ice. And they, of course, they did not believe me. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. Like this
what were you
teen
doing?
Girl
with
like my head was half shaved, but I was like very respectable looking still.
Uh-huh.
And this half broken hand. So I got my little wristband at the hospital and I went home and I woke my mom up and I was like, I didn't do any of my, like, I honestly shoved her in the night. She was sleeping.
Other hand.
Yeah. With my other hand. I was like, wake up. She was like, oh, what's going on? I'm like, I sprained my hand. I didn't do any of my Christmas exams. See you in the morning. She was like, what's happening? You're a horrible child.
Oh my God.
And then I transferred myself out of the high school that I was in and I forged all the documents to change high schools.
Oh my God.
Between December and January. And then in January, I became a good student again. And I was a normal person from there on.
Well, yeah, you must have been a good student because you go to McGill. That's a good, good school.
Yeah, I did.
But then again, after a year, you wanted out of there?
It was more like I just wanted to leave Montreal. It was a kind of a lonely experience.
Yeah.
And I just needed to be around some people that I knew.
Including
moved to
closer
Ottawa.
To your mother now.
Closer to my mom. Yep.
But I guess at University of Ottawa, the one of the big things that happened was it was there that you first performed in some way?
Yeah, definitely. I thought that I would go to law school. I thought that I would be, even though I had a criminal past, which I never caught up with me.
Were you actually arrested?
No, I was not. Yeah. I was not. I definitely could have been, but I wasn't. Right. Although I will say also in my defense, because I think that people think that I speak about this in too cavalier a fashion, but I'm actually just trying to be honest.
Right.
I do feel like I've spent a lot of years trying to repay that debt to society in different ways. Okay?
Point taken.
Let's not imagine that I feel like I got off and was like, meh, giving the finger to society.
Right,
I definitely have diligently worked to be a very responsible person.
That's true.
Yeah, I was on track to go to law school, I guess. Mm-hmm. That was my intention. Mm-hmm. Not that I wanted to do that, but just that I did... was on track to be one of the only college grads in my family or like, you know, and so I thought I needed to find a profession and that seemed to be a profession that I would be inclined toward. And so while I was tracking for that, I needed an easy class to take just to keep my GPA up.
Right.
And so I took a theater class because I thought it would be really easy and I loved it. I really loved it. But then one way that you could get credit in the class, everybody had to participate in a production in some capacity. And so I was like, I don't know, I'll just audition to be in the stupid thing. Like, I don't even know. And I did get a part in this play and it was a solo song and a couple of great scenes in a Brecht play. I loved it so much. There were so many things I didn't know. I did not know that when you did a play, you were supposed to read the whole play. I only read my own scenes.
Oh, my God.
I knew so little about it.
The performance must have been a pleasant surprise then.
I have to tell you that I loved it immediately. There was no question that, and everything changed after that.
Right.
I definitely loved it. I had no fear about it. I don't know why.
And so when you graduated from University of Ottawa, now instead of, you know, going down the law track, how do you then pursue acting as a career?
It's difficult. It's a terrible decision to make. No one in my family was excited by it, for sure. Everyone in my family was excited that I would have some type of like a future, you know? And they were very thrilled by that. So getting some waitering jobs and trying your hand in the acting business did not seem to be a practical future. And it was entirely impractical. So it was hard. It was a really hard road. I waited a lot. Yep. I struggled a lot. I didn't get hired for a long time. Mm-hmm. A long time. It was really only when I started doing comedy that I legitimately started getting hired.
And
right
the first
away.
Thing in comedy was what?
Well, I started doing, it wasn't that I was getting paid to do comedy. It's just that when I started doing sketch comedy. Mm-hmm. Like I was ever so slightly getting paid to do a little bit of theater here and there, like a play a year, you know, because when you're a struggling actor, just getting one job
something.
A year, just getting something can really can feed you for not feed you literally, but it can feed your soul or your desire.
But I saw you'd gotten some good commercials.
Yeah, but that really was only after I started doing sketch comedy.
So
I started
sketch
doing
first.
Sketch comedy because I ended up just liking it.
Yeah.
And it was fun. And then as I got more into that, it gave me a reason to be a performer and it fulfilled all of my performing needs, which relaxed me when I was auditioning for things because I felt like I didn't need those jobs. Mm-hmm. And really the key to getting any job in the acting industry is to not care about getting the job, which is a cruel reality of it because they can smell the fear on you if you really need the job.
Well, and so you were in one sketch group and then you go to the one that I think is now more known, Atomic Fireballs. Mm-hmm. So how did you first get into sketch comedy even?
Well,
there was never any stand-up for you, right? You were never...
No, I never did stand-up, no. Well, my boyfriend at the time, who is now my husband...
Yes. Who you met...
Who I met doing children's theater. ...was doing sketch comedy, and he found success at it, actually.
Yeah,
they
did
very well. They had a big following. They were called the Bob Room. And they did a couple of episodes of a TV show. Like, they were sought after, and they were thought to be one of the premier kind of sketch troupes in the Toronto scene. Mm-hmm. And Jason... always encouraged me to do it. He definitely thought that I would have an aptitude for it. And I was doing another play, which was like a teen play where you go around to high schools and it's very instructive. I was amazing in it. But I had made great friends with the cast. And someone that I knew just through a couple of connections, my friends Peter and Matt had a comedy troupe, and Craig, these three guys. And the woman in their troupe, they were called Catch 21. Mm-hmm. And the woman in their troupe had bailed on them. She was sick, or she had to withdraw from the troupe for some reason. And they asked me just to fill in for her. And Matt was like, "You will love this. I just trust me. You are going to be great at this. You're going to love it." And so I did it. And the instant that I did it, I knew that I loved it. I did love it. He was absolutely right.
So can somebody actually make enough to survive by doing sketch comedy?
Absolutely not.
No.
No way. Honestly do it for love. You do it for love and the hope that someone will see you and you'll have an opportunity to do something else. And there's always, there have been so many great sketch shows that have come out of Canada, and there's the
SCTV,
there's something in the ether that makes people think that they're searching for the next big thing in the world of sketch. So there's that backdrop, I guess.
Well, and crazily enough, I guess in your case, that is what happened but The Daily Show, you would think, could find a funny woman within the continental United States.
I think so. I know they saw a lot of people, but there was something, and this sounds like I'm disparaging myself, but actually I think they saw a lot of people. They came to Canada because of Second City, because of the connection through Second City, Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I think they just thought that there would be women there that they could look at. I was not at Second City. They would never have hired me.
How did they find the Atomic Fireballs
my agent, actually, they had set up a day where they were seeing all the women from Second City. Mm-hmm. And just the guy who organized it was friends with my agent at the time. And he didn't have enough women to make the day credible. So he was like, "Do you have any women on your roster that you can throw into the mix?" And she asked me if I had any interest in it, thinking that I would not. But The Daily Show was my favorite show. I was the only person at the audition who knew the show.
I was going to say, I can't imagine it was that big in Canada at that point.
Yeah, well, it was big in my house.
In your house, yeah.
But it was not a huge juggernaut by any stretch. So
and this is 2003?
That was in 2003.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was 2003.
So what did the audition entail, and how soon after did you find out, what was going on?
Well, I prepared for it within an inch of my life. It was my Olympics.
Because you knew if it happened.
Well, when you live in Canada and you're trying to make it work, you never think that a U.S. show, because all of these tantalizing U.S. shows would come and just see people, but never hire anybody out of Canada, never, ever. So it wasn't even really a thought in my head that they would hire me, because I just am not a great auditioner, quite frankly. And I was getting ready to kind of get out of the business. So I knew that I wanted to do the very best job possible. I knew Well, I was working at an advertising agency and stuff. I was just kind of I was on my way out of show business.
Uh-huh.
It was not, I had done all right. I had done things. It was not nothing.
Right.
But I felt like the struggle was not something that I wanted to be in for, 30 more years.
Right.
So I thought with the Daily Show audition, I was like, I'll go out with a bang. I'll go out with the best audition of my life. It's a show I truly care about. Maybe it'll make them laugh. I'll just do a really good job, and then I can feel proud. I did something. And then they hired me. It's crazy.
Do you remember where you got the news?
I do. I mean, I auditioned for them. It was a pretty simple audition. And by the way, I wanted to say that I think that they were looking for, it wasn't just that they were looking for a woman who could deliver their brand of comedy, but they also wanted to hire someone who looked a little spent.
What?
Well, I know that they really had a specific, I think they were really looking for someone a little older, someone who could be credible as a reporter, someone who'd been around a little while. They weren't looking for that super young.
Well, let's just be clear. You were only 34.
I was 34, but they weren't looking for an ingenue. Specifically were not looking for that.
Right.
So that was great for me, is what I'm saying. still attractive, but it hasn't been the easiest ride, okay?
So you get a call or something?
Yeah, I got a call back. I had to come to New York for a day, and I was I was pretty smart about it, actually. They wanted to fly me in and out the same day, but I was like, I will pay my own money. I will stay in a hotel. Mm-hmm. I will go and see a taping of the show the night before to get a feeling for the studio. I actually like the space is very important to me. Yeah. I like to just be in it, just to know what I'm dealing with.
Yeah.
I don't like to see something for the first time and then have to do something. So I went to see the show the night before. John Malkovich was the guest. I was amazed. I was very impressed. But it did settle me to just kind of know where I was going to be. And it was really helpful.
Yeah.
And then I came in. I did my callback with John. And then I left. And I was like, well, I left it all on the floor. What can I say? If I don't get the job, it's not because of me. It's not because of anything I did. It's just because they
did. Did you have to prepare something, or did they give you something to do?
They gave me scripts.
Yeah.
Yeah, they gave me a couple of scripts to memorize. Yeah. Honestly, they were someone else's scripts. Like, they were Steven's scripts that I had seen the bit. Like,
so you actually knew how to deliver it.
Well, I didn't want to do it exactly like it. Right. We're all sort of doing an impression of Steven. When you audition, you're always doing an impression of Steven. So I think that's fine.
Right.
But I didn't do it exactly as I did, although it was very close. Very close. Right. But I knew it. I knew the material really, really well. Yeah.
And so you were, what, at the advertising job?
I was at the advertising job, yeah. And my agent called me, and she was like, she was as shocked as I was. She was like, I don't know how to tell you this, but you got the job.
Oh, my God.
So I went into my boss's office, and I told him that I quit. Like, I just quit, because I was terrible at that job anyway. Right. I really was not doing him any favors by continuing. He was my friend. I loved working. Right. You know, I loved him. But I wasn't doing him any favors by being his employee. So I quit. And then he took me out and we went and get martinis at the top of the Park Hyatt. It was nice.
So what this means now is you have to move to New York.
Yeah.
You, I believe, did not come with your husband at first.
At first, because I definitely thought I was going to get fired.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, okay. You know, it's a very Canadian approach to this whole thing, but I was like, I'm definitely getting fired. So don't you displace yourself.
Right.
We owned a house, you know, we were married, we bought a house. So we had a stable existence in Toronto. So I was like, hold on. And he was working on something. I feel like he had a long run on like Queer as Folk or something. Mm-hmm. There was a show that was, he had a part on it.
Right.
So he had work to do.
It was
he had stuff to do in town. Okay, he was shooting a sketch show. Yeah. There was stuff. He was busy.
Right.
So I came on my own and I rented an apartment just over there in Hell's Kitchen. Like, I can see it from here.
Wow.
Close to the studio.
Yeah.
And I lived in a little studio apartment. And then we kind of like did weekends, or every 2 weeks we would see each other. I mean, we went into debt for the first
because of the travel
year, because of all the travel. Yeah. It was very expensive. And
but were you immediately, so you arrive at the mm-hmm. offices here, and the only woman at the on air mm-hmm. talent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And were that way until for like 5-6 years,
until
Kristen Schaal showed up. So was it lonely and intimidating, or were they very welcoming and you were right at home, or how would you describe?
Everyone was pretty welcoming, but everyone was nice, but very busy. It's insane making a strip show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one's got time to hold your hand and mm-hmm. show you the ropes. Like, as nice as everyone was, they were really doing their own jobs mm-hmm. to the very best of their abilities. So everyone was lovely, but no one could show me anything really. Mm-hmm. It is such a job that I don't know what it's like now, but at the time it was just trial and error. Just start shooting stuff, just start going on field pieces, just start traveling.
And so would your job responsibilities at that time, they were including you write your own stuff as well, or no?
No, the writers wrote stuff for the studio, but then the area where I really carved out something for myself was in the field department, because I was willing to go anywhere and do anything.
Your first thing was South Dakota, right?
I went to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. That was my first piece. That was like 3 flights.
Oh,
that's,
my God.
You know, that's like the flight that the more experienced correspondents are like, why don't we let the new girl do it?
And were you already at that time personally a political junkie, or just you kind of have to become one?
Well, I was already. I mean, it did represent the merging of my deep, deep interests mm-hmm. in a way that I never, that's why I enjoyed the show.
Yeah.
Frankly, that's why I was such a fan of the show.
Right.
So it was scary at first, because I did think like, what if I'm not enough? What if I'm not knowledgeable enough? And I really was not that knowledgeable about the U.S. political system. Knowledgeable about it, more than the average Canadian, but mm-hmm. it's not the system that you grow up in. So it's not in your DNA.
And did I once read something where you said sort of like, it's a little uncomfortable until you became a citizen with dual citizenship to even go after them in the way that you guys had
well,
to?
Well, after a while, I reflected on the fact, listen, I mean, as soon as you come here, you start paying taxes. It's not like you're not participating. Like, there's no way that you're not paying taxes immediately upon arrival. So I was definitely contributing to the system, not just bleeding off of it.
Right.
But I was happy and proud to pursue citizenship. Mm-hmm. Like, that felt correct to me. Because, I mean, I lived here for a long time. My children were born here. Mm-hmm. It was just the right thing to do. I wanted to be able to vote. I think I should have done it earlier, but honestly, my kids were little babies. And so it just became, just for practical purposes, it's hard to do all that paperwork when you have little infants.
So over the 12 plus, I believe, years that you were there, you overlapped with most of the people who have now, in fact, many of your, I don't know if you would even use the word competitors, but the other people who are doing what
my
you
cohorts,
do.
My cohorts,
your cohorts. So Stephen Colbert, John Oliver, Larry Wilmore, Trevor Noah was a guest person occasionally there at that point still, in addition to Carell and all these other guys, right? So it was a pretty interesting time. Is there anybody there who you particularly were close to or influenced by or took things away from that you've since applied in your own adventures?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I mean, obviously, I think I learned a tremendous amount from John himself. Like, there's no getting around it. He just is the best in the business. And he kind of, he was very encouraging. It was really hard work. You know, we spent a lot of our time just kind of like trying to interpret John's thoughts. Like, what would John want for this? And how would John feel about this? And he mentored me. Like, I mean, he mentored all of us, really. So I would say John was the main takeaway for sure.
And as you look back at all those years there, is there a sketch or segment or something that you're particularly proudest of? I mean, I remembered you talking about the conventions, and I think Stephen also said that was like a highlight. And
the conventions were always really highlights because it was, for the amount of work that you did, it was very satisfying. It was very, very satisfying to go to the conventions. They were really hard to do.
Right.
It's really challenging. It remains challenging. It was challenging doing my own show and going to the conventions. It's just hard to be out of your element and sticking cameras in people's faces and just chasing people around. That's not usually what you do, and it is exhausting.
One of the things that you were and are particularly good at is getting people to say things that do not reflect well on themselves in a way where they don't even realize that they're doing
it. Well, I feel like I was always good at getting people to boil down the essence of how they feel about things. Mm-hmm. Like, I was not of the mindset to trick people. Mm-hmm. I was always actually transparent about what my intentions were, or I grew to be more and more transparent.
Right.
Once I figured out that you didn't need to trick people into saying what they thought. You just needed to encourage them enough that they would feel comfortable to say what they actually thought about things. So, and now with this show, of course, there's no artifice whatsoever. Like now, just openly, transparently, so obvious. But I think I tried to create an atmosphere for people in which they would feel comfortable to be themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't always like how they sounded after the fact.
But they said it.
But it always was a reflection of how they truly felt.
Right.
That's not my fault.
Right. So can you clarify some chronology? Because in prepping for this, I've read a whole bunch of articles where they're presenting it in different ways. Did you, when you left The Daily Show, had you already been aware, A, that John was leaving, and or B, that someone other than you was going to be the next host? Did you know that?
Well, I'll tell you the chronology.
Okay.
So in September of, I guess, 2014? Okay. Well, I'll forget the year, but I think it's 2014. Mm-hmm. In September of 2014, TBS bought a script from Jason and I.
Mm-hmm.
For the Detour.
The Detour.
So we wrote a script for them. They greenlit it. We shot the pilot in December of 2014 in North Carolina. We loved it so much. We were like, this is it. We always knew the whole time we were there that our next step was to work together on something, probably scripted.
Scripted, yeah.
And we had been laying that groundwork for years. We sold lots of pilots. We sold film scripts. We were constant. We thought of ourselves and knew ourselves as producers and writers for sure. Mm-hmm. And that would be our future. And Jason had produced movies in Toronto. Like, it was just a part of how we are do-it-yourself people. Mm-hmm. So we filmed that in December, and we loved it. It was an incredible experience. Our collaboration with the network was great. We loved the script. We loved the family. We loved the world that we created. So we were dying for it mm-hmm. to get greenlit as a series. TBS at the time was in a period of transition, mm-hmm. so we didn't know. It's impossible to know. You just mm-hmm. cross your fingers and pray. So then January, I guess we were in the edit or they were reviewing it or whatever. And then I think in February, that is when John announced that he was leaving.
Correct.
So there was a week-long period. We did not expect him to announce that he was stepping down. We didn't know what was happening with the Detour, and there was really nothing else happening. As soon as he stepped down, I guess, you know, conversations were happening about me, but it didn't seem realistic to me.
When you say conversations were happening,
everyone was like, well, who's going to replace John?
But had anyone said to you, would you be interested or anything
like
that?
Not at all. No. So I didn't really know what was going to happen. We had a period of that week in February where we were a little bit lost mm-hmm. and we knew that that day was coming.
Right.
We knew that we were going to leave, and we knew that the show would end for us. We didn't know which would come first. Mm-hmm. It's always shocking. When it's
for years
real.
And years and years.
Yeah. When it's just all of a sudden real.
Right.
It just materializes and you go, oh, let me cry. Okay. And then let me reset.
Right.
So we went out to L.A. because we had another little job to do. And while we were in L.A., TBS told us that they greenlit the Detour.
Wow.
Which was incredible.
Big news, yeah. And
it was
good timing.
Huge news. Great timing. And they basically, around that time, offered me the opportunity to do my own show.
And in terms of late night / talk show, mm-hmm. whatever, they had gotten into that for the first time with Conan.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they were looking to continue to grow that area.
To grow that area. But I think they saw it. I mean, I'm paraphrasing. I mean, I'm like trying to get into their heads. Mm-hmm. But I think that they saw a property. I'm going to refer to myself as a property that had great possibility.
Yeah.
They saw tremendous potential.
Yeah.
And I give them an amazing amount of credit for that, because there was no other network really going like, hey, we got to get her to do something.
Particularly, though, weirdly, you're saying including Comedy Central.
Well,
did that bother you? Is that, I would think that's a little weird that not. Well, but here's the other question, though. In fairness, do you think that it wasn't even an option?
I don't
by
think
the
that,
time they got
I don't know
around
what was in I don't know what was in their heads, but it did not seem like a real option to me.
You didn't think it was going to happen? Yeah.
Oh God, no. Not even close. Even though people around me wanted to believe that to some extent, I knew the truth was that that was not an option.
So at that point though, when you're leaving to go to do mm-hmm. Full Frontal at TBS, if it had flopped and mm-hmm. been canceled after your 13 episodes that you were guaranteed or whatever, what would you have done?
Well, I would have been working on the Detour. I mean, I would have
focus.
Probably focused on, I would have focused on scripted, but it wouldn't look so, I mean, I had other ideas for late night shows for sure. I would have had to go around town and start pitching myself.
Was there any scenario where you would have stayed at the Daily Show under another anchor?
No.
I didn't think
no,
so.
No,
yeah.
no. You know, we were there for a long time. Yeah. I was there for 12 years. So it really didn't matter to me who the next person was.
Right.
It was just the right time to leave. Like, it was just the correct time. You know,
right.
if you look to the universe to tell you when to make a break, that was it. That was it. So Jason left. I mean, the writing room for the Detour fired up in April. So he left. And then I left shortly after I left in May. Because we wrote all through the summer and shot all through the summer. And then I wasn't really getting Full Frontal going. They wanted to get that first season of the Detour shot.
Right.
And then we started firing up.
And it helps to have them both at the same network so that you can coordinate.
Yeah. They were generous about like a time frame. And so I didn't really start digging into Full Frontal in earnest. I left the Detour set a little early to mm-hmm. come back and start creating that.
One of the first things that got a lot of attention after the announcement that you would eventually be doing Full mm-hmm. Frontal, but before it was on the air, was that Vanity Fair in 2015 runs this photo with like probably a dozen of the other late night people, all men in, you know, suits and ties with martinis and everything. It was just almost like I don't know how they could have not realized what the reaction would be when, meanwhile, you and Chelsea Handler had been announced, but not yet, were not yet on
yes.
the air, right?
And Trevor had been announced, but he was not yet on the air, and he was in the photo.
Oh, he was in there.
Yes.
Do you remember when you saw that for the first time, what your reaction was?
I was on Long Island. It was in the fall. It was like September or something like that, and I was at a pumpkin patch with Jason and the kids. We were picking pumpkins, and there was a play area, like a wooden pirate ship area. And I was on Twitter, and people started tweeting this photo to me. And now, as I'm actually, my friend Alana, who's a producer here and a correspondent here, she reminded me that she was like, "Oh my God, you got to get your face in there." And I was like, "What?" And then I looked and I was like, "Oh my God, I got my face in there." And then I texted Miles, who's an executive producer here, who runs the field department. And I was like, "Do you have that photo you made of me?" Because he had made a photo of me as a centaur with laser eyes for a different purpose. And I just kept it in my phone because I was like, this is funny.
Yeah.
I like this photo.
Right.
And so he photoshopped it in for me. And then I just tweeted it to them. And then it went viral. Blew up from there.
Yeah.
So Alana and Miles made that kind of happen.
But what that incident says to us is what? You took it, and I assume, because I would have, as sort of, this is a ridiculous
flight. It was just ridiculous.
Right?
It was just so silly.
Right.
It was just such a silly moment.
But it was also the response to your correction of it was, there's an untapped audience here who's very supportive of the idea that you should be in there.
That was very gratifying. I actually felt that surge of, it was the first or second time where I really felt like, oh, there are people here who are interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be all right. There's an active group of people who care about this. Okay, I like it.
So early 2016, I think, is when you guys first went on the air, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just to give people a sense of the scale of it, it was you, I guess, is showrunner the right title for at that time, Joe Miller, who had been a writer at the Daily Show with you. And then how many other people worked here?
I don't have a strong sense of the numbers. Maybe like around 50 people. Mm-hmm. I think we have about 60 or 70 people now. So maybe slightly fewer than that then. But you really have to assemble a pretty big team to do a show like this, no matter what.
And for you, as with, interestingly, I think Trevor, it seems like there was a concerted from day one effort to make sure that it was built from the ground up with unusual, but shouldn't be unusual diversity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you go about that? Why was that important to you, and how'd you go about it?
Well, I think the world was calling for that. I think it just felt necessary.
Mm-hmm.
It's just it was in our DNA. It continues to be so.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes a place better.
Yeah.
It just makes a point of view better, makes the place more well-rounded.
And you ended up with, I saw, 50% women,
something like
that. 1/3 people of color or something.
It's good. I don't know. You know, obviously people have come and gone since then, so I don't actually know
what the
statistics are now. But we always have an eye to it. It's like just part of our routine, our hiring routine.
You guys have always been once a week. I guess it works out to 20-21 minutes, right?
About 21 minutes.
Why is that the format that makes the most sense for you?
Once a week makes sense for me because, I mean, it's a very intense show. It's actually very intense. The research is deep.
Mm-hmm.
The research is deep. And I like to do field work.
Yeah.
I like to go out in the world. It's important to me. And you really can't do that and have a strip show. You can send people out, but you can't do it yourself. And I do like to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I like to send people out for sure, but I also like to do it myself.
Yeah.
It's my love. I love it. And I knew that it wouldn't be possible. You just can't travel. 4 shows a week takes everything you've got.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you've got. And I have, not to say that, it's not like I'm like, well, I have kids. But I do have a life that I enjoy.
Right.
And I wanted to be able to live my life somewhat.
Right.
Even knowing that, it is still so absorbing.
Yeah.
Doing 1 show a week takes all of my available time away from my children, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when I'm here, I'm truly here. When I'm with them, I'm truly with them. And there is nothing else. Sometimes I work out. But that's my free time.
Well, so how clear was your vision when you, after all these years of working at a show where somebody else was ultimately the decider, now you come here, things like no desk, things like the structure and the way that you're going to pack so much at a rapid pace into the 21 minutes. Did you have that whole idea in mind from the very beginning, or did it evolve?
Well, we definitely started the show with the intention to, like, to kick the barn doors in. That was what we said from the very beginning, that the show could should absolutely come from the gut, kick the doors in, and that is it, and have it be the purest essence of, you know, how we truly feel about things. And so we've stayed pretty true to to that. And we didn't know what it would look like. That's the thing. Like, until you put it on its feet, it didn't really probably feel that way until we did our first episode.
Right.
You know, it's hard to rehearse a show like this. Like, you do these test shows, but they're weird and they're not really fun, and you're trying stuff out, and none of the, you know, your monitors aren't ready and everything. There's all kinds of technical problems.
Right. What was the biggest learning curve to be a host now, as opposed to, and not only the host, but the person overseeing everything?
It's the biggest learning curve is actually just like handling a big staff of people. That is not
management.
Management is very difficult.
Yeah.
It challenges me every single day. It's not what I went into comedy for.
Right.
That's for sure.
Right.
It's a real challenge. It's hard to do. It's hard to do well. I fail at it constantly. I succeed at it in other ways.
Really?
Like, that has by far and away been more difficult than the product itself.
I've spoken for this podcast with a number of these other folks that are in this still pretty small club of doing some variation of what you do. And I thought it was interesting. I always ask, like, do you watch the others? Is there a value to seeing what they're doing or how they're doing it or whatever? And most of the answers have been because either not having time to watch them or not wanting to inadvertently incorporate things that some people say they watch monologues, like for I guess, what's your attitude about, I mean, it sounds like time's a crunch anyway.
It's always a time crunch. When I'm relaxing, I don't find it relaxing to watch comedy at all. I don't watch the other shows. We have someone here who does to make sure that we don't cross streams, you know, content-wise. But I don't really watch them because it's not so much, I don't know. I don't really have time, and it doesn't feel like fun. That feels like work to me,
right.
Even though
you could
those guys are great. I mean, they're all great, but you go, well, I'd like to watch something that's outside of this world.
Right.
Just if I'm going to watch something,
let
it be called, The Midwife.
Right. It seems like for all of late night or talk shows, and certainly for yours, there was a very clear turning point, which was election night. What were you doing? How did your plans change as it became clear that Trump was going to win? And also just in a bigger picture, I read about you looking at your social media that night and your whole outlook changed. So just as it sunk in that night, how did your professional life change?
Well, it was a really, it was like slowly descending into a sunken place for sure that night, because we had a show the next day. That week we did a show on the Monday, and we had planned a big post-election show on the Wednesday with a balloon drop and a really fancy blazer and a musical guest who was going to sing like Good as Hell. I mean, you know, this really fun show that we had planned. So as the realization crept upon us, we actually had to change the entire show to restructure, you know, and thank God we have just the most amazing writers and the most amazing producers, and people had shot material. Everybody had, the correspondents had gone out and shot man on the streets and material at the polling places. And we had to rejigger that completely to reflect the new reality. Not that it was actually not that hard to find a different point of view with the same material, actually. It was just it was an all-nighter for sure. Everyone worked so hard. It was we pulled an all-nighter basically.
And the social media, you were like, that's it.
Oh, I started reading my social media in the night, and it was crazy. Like, I can't even accurately give you a picture of it. It just, the turn was so palpable into like darkness and it felt so dangerous.
Because people were emboldened.
All of a sudden, people were so emboldened, and they were sending me the most horrific messages all of these people just crawled out from under a rock to say the worst possible stuff on social media. It was shocking.
Right.
It was shocking. And people had always said terrible stuff, but like this was in particular, I felt a shift in the air, like all the oxygen.
And as he actually assumed office and whatever, I'm trying to remember, was the what you have called the furious woman persona, basically the sort of tone of, I guess, outrage that that your persona as the host has, was that there even before the election, or was that really there afterwards?
Sure, it was there before, but I don't remember it as keenly.
Yeah,
it was there before for sure, because things that happened during that election cycle, especially when he became the leader of the party.
Right.
I mean, that was when he secured the nomination. It was so crazy and shocking. And the things and the dog whistles that we had been hearing all along were felt so threatening and crazy. And we took the strongest possible stand to repudiate all of those messages. And still he won. So, yeah, the outrage was pre-election. But we did think that, not that, you listen, no one here thought that Hillary Clinton was going to solve all of our problems.
Right.
Like, no one here thought we wouldn't have a show if she was the president.
There's always stuff.
There's always material. There's always stuff to talk about 21 minutes a week.
Right.
Now there's stuff to talk about 800 minutes a week.
Right.
You know.
And probably changing up until the minute you go on the air because there's so much happening.
It's rapid fire. It's impossible to even keep up with. I'm sure something, since we've been talking, I'm sure something terrible has happened. We could be at war with Syria. We don't even, who knows?
Well, it's exciting to find
out. We'll all find out.
Do you have a theory for why Hillary did not win? You said something here just in reference to your own, as you were getting ready to go on the air, quote, "There are plenty of people who won't tune in because a woman's voice bothers their eardrums. Their ear canals can't handle the sound of my shrill voice talking at them about a subject," close quote. I mean, as a glass ceiling breaker in your own field, do you see what she was up against?
Sure. And we kind of the way that we interpreted it here, we thought that she would win by a narrow margin, for sure. There's a lot of, I mean, the misogyny was, I mean, it was very apparent during the campaign. But we thought that she would win. And then we thought that the next 4 years would just be like riding a tidal wave of the deepest misogyny pouring out of people.
Right.
Like, we just thought, like, immediately she would be under investigation and, like, under indictment. And all of these things would happen to block everything that she did. And we knew that it would be incredibly frustrating and would feel dangerous and terrible. But I wasn't prepared for her to lose.
Yeah, I don't think anyone said
No.
Well, the last thing is just a very rapid fire three things.
Oh, sure.
That's okay.
Oh, I'm so bad at rapid fire. Watch me go really slowly.
You can do it slow. That's fine.
Okay.
Number one, your show has had overall phenomenal success since it went on the air. I saw after the first year, its viewership was up 167%.
Jeez, I didn't know that.
That doesn't happen very often.
That's lovely.
But especially with adults 18 to 34.
Good.
To what do you attribute that?
Prime,
you know,
meat.
With that demographic? Yeah, exactly. But like, can you see why that would be? Why would young people in particular be tapping into your show?
Well, I do think that the one thing that the show is it's very authentic experience.
Yes.
Like, and young people can sniff that out. They can sniff out the inauthentic like 10 miles away.
Yes.
So, I mean, I like to think that you can feel the reality.
Number two, what's the biggest danger that you feel of hosting the show, in the sense like, what could you do that would cause an episode to go off the rails?
Oh, I could do anything to cause, it would be easy for an episode to go off the rails. I mean, it could go off the rails. We have a show, our first show back is next week.
Mm-hmm.
Something could happen at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on show day that could cause the show to go off the rails. You know, it's not just what we would do. I think the world is happening at a very frenetic pace now. There's no predictability in our lives right now whatsoever.
You've also said it's sort of, you've got to navigate, I think, the tightrope of, you got to be outraged, but also funny. If you take it too seriously,
then you're too much of an activist. If you don't take it seriously enough, it's not enough, you know?
So it's always
You're always kind of like, there is a fine line that you have to ride.
So lastly, we've seen what it's like for you with Trump, where on the one hand, comedically, I guess there's endless reserves of things to make fun of. But on the other hand, there are, you know, like we were just talking about, the fact that it's at the price of the world being insane. So
I would happily take, I would take a more predictable world and just like a slight struggle to find three more jokes.
That's very noble, very selfless. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I'm a really good citizen. You're really lucky to have me now.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. This is really nice.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.